Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, Han is joined by David Coyle. David is a consultant psychiatrist and the clinical lead for adult eating disorder services across multiple trusts in Northern Ireland. With a career spanning 18 years in mental health and 7 years specialising in eating disorders, David is dedicated to his clinical work, especially where he can be creative and innovative. He is also passionate about teaching and provides training for various healthcare disciplines in the region. One of his notable interests is the introduction of mentalisation-based treatment as part of the treatment options available within his services, which focuses on severe and complex eating disorders. I really enjoyed this week's podcast with David. For one, I absolutely adore David, but more so, it was really interesting to learn more about mentalisation, something that I don't think we often hear about a lot, but something that I have been working through a lot recently with my recent ADHD diagnosis, and understanding how that could then interact with the eating disorder was really, really useful. So I hope you enjoy the episode, and I hope you find it as interesting as I did. David, it's so nice to have you back on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming back. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for having me back.
Brilliant. Yeah, it's very exciting to have you back to actually talk about the thing that we had set out initially to talk about.
Well, it was a good detour the last time, I was glad of it. So.
Yes, absolutely. And I think very topical at the moment. So It had really good feedback as well. And a lot of people were really, really grateful for us speaking about it, because I think it is a topic for people that haven't listened to the episode yet. It was about palliative care for eating disorders. And people were very grateful that we approached the subject, because it is something that some people do have to consider. And they said, you know, you came at it from a very caring perspective and could see that, you know, how much you cared about your patient. So yes, it was a very well received episode, hence having you back for another one.
Well, I'll try not to disappoint.
So I guess if people haven't listened to the other episode, do you want to just introduce yourself and let us know what kind of stuff you get up to?
Sure. So David Coyle, I am a consultant psychiatrist, and I am the clinical lead for regional eating disorder services here in Northern Ireland. Actually made official week before last. I interviewed for Woo-hoo! It, and it's finally been recognised officially. But
congratulations.
Thank you. I'm based in Belfast, but fully cover two trusts worth of clinical input. And I've been doing it now for almost 8 years, actually, which is mad. I never intended to do it, and then just landed in it and found out I loved it. So
that's awesome. And I'm sure for a lot of aspiring clinicians, that's kind of interesting to hear, because I've got a lot of friends that are doing their like assistant psychology and going on to being clinical psychologists, and all of them, pretty much all of them, I would say, were like, when they first started, they were like, I want to work in this discipline, or, you know, what have you. And actually, through doing their training, they've kind of gone in a completely different direction to what they were expecting, which I think has been really interesting for them. But it's also been really interesting for me to see their journey of, like, one friend in particular, she was so set on doing eating disorders. And then as she did her training, she's now got into addiction, and she really finds that really rewarding. So that's been really cool to see her progression.
I would quite often have medical students with me and nursing students, actually, and the approach to careers advice is, I think, sometimes a little cart before horse, that quite often people place it on their placements, you know, how did I enjoy doing that? But it's one placement, it's one context, and all it takes is either really loving the people that you're working with and then realizing, well, that doesn't mean you're going to be working with them if you choose this as your future specialty, or vice versa, I hate it because of the people that I'm working with and then you've missed out. And I always say to them, no, try and base your choices around your personal characteristics instead. Know yourself a bit better. Know what do I enjoy, what gives me a sense of satisfaction, what makes me feel like my job is worth it. And then work from there because different specialties have kind of archetypes of what makes them enjoyable.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're so right. I mean, I think that's with any profession, really. The people that you work with make such a difference to what you're doing. And I can imagine as well that in this context, sometimes, I guess, maybe particularly with eating disorders, I don't know, but I've heard a lot of people say that it is a challenging discipline to be in because you don't necessarily get to see someone reach full recovery. You know, if you were going to work with, I mean, well, I guess there could be psychology involved in this, but let's say you're working with a cancer patient, you would hope that you would see them to full recovery because otherwise they wouldn't be ending their treatment, or obviously it could go the other way. But with eating disorders, I guess sometimes you say goodbye to people before you kind of you started them on their journey before, sorry, you've started them on their journey rather than seeing them through to the end.
That's particularly true, I think, of medics, especially in my position, in that I'm usually drafted in for people when they're at their absolute worst, because by the time that they're doing well, they don't need to see me anymore. They're seeing their therapist. And sometimes the therapist will book people into clinic, and I ask, as I always do, why am I seeing them? What do you want from this? And oh, it's just to brighten your day a bit because they're doing really well. And so they'll just
That's
book
so
people in.
kind.
Just be like, oh yeah, I just thought it would bring it along and say, look, this is working.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's lovely that they do that because I can imagine that does really help. So to bring us on to the conversation of, you know, the topic that we were going to discuss today, we, when we originally met, spoke about MBT and how that works for eating disorders. So I guess for people that are like, what on earth is that? What is MBT?
But that includes people who do MBT. Quite often, what on earth is it?
Yeah. I have to say, when I did my master's in eating disorders, we learned about MBT, and still now I'm like, yeah, I just don't really get it.
Well, sometimes when you learn about it in theory, it confuses you even further. I mean, I find it's the actual doing of it that then I think, all right, I get this, and sometimes even I step out of a group or out of the room and I think, oh no, I don't get it anymore, and then I go back in and then I do. So the tagline that you quite often hear is that it's thinking about thinking, which in of itself doesn't mean very much, very esoteric, but my way of thinking about it, or my way of explaining it, if I'm trying to pitch it to a patient and say you should come along and do this, is that it's helping you to better understand and articulate what is going on in your own mind in terms of both thoughts and emotion, and better understand what might be going on in the emotions and thoughts of the people around you, and how those two things interrelate. So how your thoughts and emotions correlate and are affected by and affect the emotions and thoughts of others.
Okay. So almost it's around being able to understand your own emotions, but then also having empathy for other people's emotions, and then also acknowledging how other people's emotions affect your emotions.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. And from my very limited, as I said, understanding of doing my master's, mentalization is something that people with eating disorders sometimes aren't very skilled in.
Well, it's mentalization is something that very few people, full stop, are particularly skilled in. It's the only, I always say this, that it's the only therapy that I find myself really directly applying in my own personal life as well, because all of us can be poor mentalizers at different times and good mentalizers at other times. And you kind of have a mentalizing toolkit that you carry around, that different people have different tools and different quality of tools and quantity of tools. And so the idea is that Some individuals who suffer from mental ill health generally, but in this context, eating disorder, have less refined tools on that front, and so can benefit from additional learning and experience and support on that front.
And how would you say, if you were to think about, I guess, more traditional therapies, I don't even know what I'm referring to there, but is there a big difference in terms of how it is? I guess maybe more like talking therapies, things like that. Is there a difference in the way that it's sort of presented and executed with patients?
I think most therapies have kind of filtered down or percolated down from kind of the original psychoanalytic, psychodynamic type therapies, and then our various derivations of that. I mean, when I think traditional therapies for eating disorder, I obviously think CBT, mantra, you know, SSEM, those kind of nice recommended therapies. MBT, sometimes when I try to wrap my head around it, feels like psychoanalysis made accessible and made easy. And it's a little bit more dynamic and a little bit more active. So usually that kind of psychoanalytic engagement is that you're there as the patient and that the psychoanalyst is this kind of blank sheet that you are there to, you know, process with. Whereas in MBT, as a practitioner, you're another mind in the room. So it's much more equitable. You know, you have to bring your own thoughts and feelings into the room, which is very, you know, that's usually avoided by therapeutic practitioners, that they're not as keen to bring their own thoughts and feelings in. And I think that's why I was drawn to it. And actually, it came up recently where I had the experience of realizing that one of my defensive practices is to become very professional and aloof. And that when I switch into a more professional, aloof way of engaging, I then have to catch myself and think something's going wrong here because I'm doing this and this is not good. Whereas whenever I'm a more relaxed, honest, affable version of myself who occasionally does things like swear and uses colloquialisms and just tells people what's in my mind, that's when I get the best outcomes and that I engage best with my patients, you know. So I think MBT is that. It's being a real version of yourself as an example to the people that you're hoping to do the therapy with.
That's so interesting that you say that, because from my perspective, I've kind of always thought that it's, you know, if you're asking somebody, you know, like an eating disorder patient to come into the clinic with you and be open and honest about how they're feeling, that's made really, really difficult if you're sat across from somebody that you have no connection with or idea about. But obviously within the space, it is professional and client. So it must be quite difficult to, I guess, navigate that balance of, I need to remain, I guess, professional because I'm doing my job here, but equally, I need to form some sort of connection. And in order to form that connection, I need to show that I'm a real human being with my own things going on, but I guess not bring your own things going on to necessarily to the table.
Yes, you're not coming into an appointment and saying, oh, would you hear what happened to me on my way to work this morning, you know. But you are bringing your real sense of yourself in a kind of reactive way to what's in the room with the patient. That may include saying something like, do you know what, some of the tension in the air today might be me, not you, because I didn't, you know, I came into this room carrying some tension that has nothing to do with you, so I'm sorry for that. It might include something along those lines, but usually it's just being more honest about what you're thinking at any given moment with the patient there in front of you. But that still is hard, because people, it's whether they have insight and whether they realize that their aloofness and their professionalism is for their own sake, not for the sake of the patient that they're with.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because it sounds like quite a different, I guess, way of being within treatment as a professional. Because I don't know, when I think about something like CBT, that's so scripted, with kind of clear guidelines of, you know, in week one you do this, in week one you do that, in week two you do this. MBT feels quite a lot more what would the, I don't know what the word would be, but I guess not prescribed. But I wonder, within MBT, is there sort of some structure that you follow in order to kind of support somebody build that those mentalization techniques?
So we I suppose it would be helpful probably to describe what it is that we actually do within the service. Mm-hmm. Originally, it started out, what we provided was a 10-week kind of psychoeducational approach to MBT. I worked in the self-harm and personality disorder service for a year in my training, and so that's where I learned about MBT originally. So I used their materials and modified it for the purposes of eating disorder instead. And we did that for a while, found that it was really, really helpful. We also did it for both patients and carers and found both helpful. Then we evolved it. And so now what we run is a 24-week group, 12 weeks of which is kind of didactic MBT. So it's still group discussion and engagement and interaction, but there's specific topics week on week. And we take people through that to try and reach at the end a communal sense of what is MBT and how can it go wrong, how can it go right, and so on. And then a 12-week open group where we're all afforded the opportunity to practice the skills that we've acquired in the first 12 weeks. Further to that, we are now starting in September a long-term mentalizing group for graduates of the 24-week group who we think are benefiting from it and want to continue mentalizing in a group format. And as of yet, the 24-week group, we run it for patients and for carers. So, and it's a treatment group. So they, not at the same time, we have a group of carers and a group of patients, and they are both treated. Up until this point, we have yet to receive a single point of negative feedback from any participants.
Wow.
And every single participant has improved their scores on our kind of questionnaires across the board.
Wow.
We've also had some patients who are very, very kind of chronically underweight who have tried CBT and tried Mantra, and just kind of by happenstance, because it's not a focus within the MBT, have begun to restore weight whilst in the group.
Huh. Why do you think that is?
Because they're dealing with the fundamental problem of kind of emotional dysregulation and engaging with others and understanding themselves. And, they're actually cutting past, excuse my French, but all that crap that, you know, gets thrown up in the way to, this is actually what's wrong here. This is what you're finding difficult. And so if we treat that, well, then by proxy, the other stuff should start to improve. And that then has been the case. Whereas whenever we focus on the proxy, the original problem quite often goes overlooked. Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting as well that you bring the parents in, because I can imagine, you know, I definitely found this in my own recovery. I was going on leaps and bounds in my sessions, and as an individual, I was feeling so much more confident, so much more flexible around food and all of this. But my partner and my parents had so much fear, or I guess so much past experiences of me acting in a specific way around certain foods or around certain situations, that whenever those situations happened, irrespective of how I navigated it, they were struggling with it. And so I think to bring, you know, loved ones in is so important in that respect, because it helps them to kind of untangle what's been going on as well. Because at the end of the day, you know, experiencing a loved one with an eating disorder is really difficult. Mm-hmm. And then the person that's got the eating disorder does all that work and they're like, oh yeah, I'm great now, let's go and live life. And then the loved one's kind of like, but I've just had years of you behaving in a certain way and I'm just expected to kind of be okay, or, you know how to navigate this new person.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a lot there, in that, you know, what you're talking about is something that we come across quite regularly whenever the loved ones, and we've had both parents and partners. It's interesting that you led with parents, but you then mentioned your partner, and we sort of both have been invited in on different occasions. We made the mistake of inviting them simultaneously into one group, and that was not good. It wasn't fair on the partner to be in with the in-laws, do you know?
No.
Not do that again.
No, I can't see that being a positive. My parents and my partner get on like a house on fire, but no, that I don't think that would go very well.
But not in therapy together.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we constantly have to remind people about, and it takes weeks and weeks and weeks for them to wrap their heads around it, is no, this is not a support group. This is treatment. You know, you in this context are here to experience what it's like to address and examine your own mentalizing deficits so that you can work on that, so that your life is easier. This is not about how much you can help manage your loved one. Where, you know, your loved one's doing that. Where this is about you managing yourself better. And then again, by proxy, that might actually be helpful. And our best outcomes have been whenever parents or partner and patient have been in the two groups simultaneously, and it has changed the culture and the conversation at home quite significantly. Equally, we've noticed that whenever we have a group of carers for treatment, those who don't seem to get it or really struggle with it quite often are the carers of the individuals who are really struggling to improve themselves. You know, so whenever there's something has got stuck in the system, everything grinds to a halt. So I suppose this innovation, or, you know, having MBT in both for carers and for patients, was to try and keep the whole, put lots of WD-40 essentially on the system and make sure that it keeps running.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it helps everybody to feel supported and held, because like I said, you know, I don't know, but I can kind of see from my own experience that, you know, having somebody that you love experience an eating disorder is really difficult. And I guess this is not to push blame or anything of the sort, but a lot of the time, well, and I shouldn't say a lot of the time, again, I don't know the research, so I'm going to just quote my experience. But something I found, especially over the past few months when my recovery has really, like, you know, skyrocketed, is a lot of the things I struggle with, I'm now experiencing my parents struggle with. Mm-hmm. And I was saying to my mum the other day how interesting it is that I was like, this is not me blaming you at all, but it is really interesting to kind of think about the things that I struggle with and then actually see them, you know, oh, I'm now recognizing them in you. And, you know, it's not to say that it's your fault that I now feel like that. It's how can we all work together so that, you know, we're able to navigate that and it not be something that we all struggle with, because then we all can live a more free life rather than me being, you know, running off down the street thinking I'm recovered, I'm brilliant, and then my parents are at the top of the road thinking, but we're nowhere near better.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not fair to not address the subject or shy away from it because of exactly the problem that you've brought up, which is that people can immediately become quite defensive and say this is a blaming conversation. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think I said to you the last time or in the last podcast that I quite often do say to people, look, I don't blame you. But let's sit down together. Let's have a think about this. Let's understand what's not working. Let's try and make it work better. And then if you keep doing it, I will start blaming you. Do you know, because we've had a sit down and we've had a think about what could be different. But that includes we have to take responsibility for that as professionals too. So if we sit down and reflect and we think we're not engaging properly with this patient or we're not helping them in the way that we should, and if we think what we could do differently and then don't do it, well, then we're also to blame, you know. Mm-hmm. So everybody has to do the work for it to work.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And I think that's the thing with any treatment, is often with eating disorders, it is about all coming together as a group and working on it together. You know, I think you see the biggest struggles when people are trying to work against each other, in particular, you know, if the patient's with the eating disorder and then everybody else is on their own side. Mm-hmm. It was something I wanted to ask in terms of, you mentioned questionnaires and, you know, that people have had like really improved outcomes. On your questionnaires, what sort of things are you looking at in with your patients to kind of see where they're improving?
Good question. So we give everybody the EDQ. So as a within the region and, you know, as a kind of standard, we give that anyway. And so we have seen some improvements for those, as I say, with who are measured on those kind of official scores as well. And our only exclusion criteria from the group is active weight loss. So we don't have any other exclusion criteria, which means that we have individuals in the group who are very low body weight, mm-hmm. but who would be excluded from every other therapeutic modality. You know, they don't, you know, in that, for example, if somebody has comorbid personality disorder, we might take them into this group and offer treatment that is geared towards personality disorder at a BMI of say 14 or 15, mm-hmm. but good luck getting them seen by a personality disorder service because their BMI is so low. So we can tolerate that, but we always do say to people, look, as long as you're static, at least preferably improving, but the active decline, then that's the only grounds that we might say maybe this isn't for you at this time. But we haven't had to withdraw anybody as of yet, so you know, that's positive. But a lot of the other questionnaires weren't really fit to purpose for eating disorders, so I ended up creating a questionnaire with Likert scores, and it was all around, do I understand my eating disorder? Do I understand my emotions? How much do I understand the emotions of others? How much do I think the emotions of others impact on me? How much do I think my emotions impact on other people? Et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, how much do I have a positive sense of well-being about myself? And so there's a series of questions. Interestingly, what we found is all scores improved. And the only two that seemed to decline whenever we looked at the nature of the questions. So the questions were around, one of them was, I impact, my emotions impact on others. And the second was, I have a good understanding of my own emotions. And everybody rated themselves as higher than did the MBT group, and rated themselves as lower. So kind of learned, oh, hang on a minute, I do impact, and maybe I don't understand my own emotional content as well as I thought I did. And actually, we took that as a positive, that, you know, there was more kind of insight and more reflection on that. And that certainly in the qualitative feedback, that's what we're seeing, is people saying, I wish I'd done this sooner. I wish somebody had taught me these things. I wish I knew this language, particularly those who have come through the CAM system and then maybe now are engaged with adults and their parents are being taught MBT skills. And they're so contrary and so different from what they experienced within the world of CAMs, and thinking, why didn't somebody not tell us this sooner? You know.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so interesting what you were saying about how people kind of realized, oh, maybe I didn't understand my emotions and I didn't understand the impact that I was having on others. And maybe I've been doing some mentalizing over the past few months, I don't know, because I literally this today recorded a video on talking about how I would internalize everything as my fault, and then that would have a really big impact on me. And so because of that, I'd be then like, okay, well, now I need to suffer because I've done everything wrong, and that's upset everybody. And so that was where I would restrict, because I, you know, didn't feel like I deserved to eat or what have you. And then also I felt like I needed to look a certain way in order to then please people. And then actually now I've been able to realize that all that internalizing I did of how much of an impact I had on people, I guess maybe mine is the flip, is that I thought that the impact I had on people was like absolutely life changing. But in actual fact, you know, something I said or whatever, they literally didn't even acknowledge, kind of like it just floated into the distance. So that's really interesting, I guess, that shift in both ways. Either you kind of reduce the impact that you think you have on others, or you realize, oh shit, yeah, my actions do actually really impact people around me.
Although it's interesting, because that's hard too. It's hard to then suddenly think, well, maybe nobody noticed, and maybe I didn't have that much mm-hmm. impact. Because when you know, there's something both painful and also validating to think that you're having a significant impact on others, mm-hmm. and it might, yes, on one front be easier to think, oh, they didn't even notice, but on another front think, oh my god, they didn't even notice.
Yeah. <Do you know? laughs> Yeah, exactly. Like you go from thinking, I don't know, like your, I wouldn't say necessarily my presence, but sometimes I I guess, blamed myself for everything. And then you realise that nobody else is blaming you for that. And on one hand, like you say, like, oh, God, what a relief. It wasn't all my fault. But then at the same time, you're like, yeah, but I am the person that fixes everything and I do everything. So if they don't blame me for it, then that means they don't think like that.
Yeah, it's so complicated. And it's actually even more, you know, so blame's a good example, because blame and guilt and shame and are so fundamental to eating disorder as kind of emotional states, or thinking states, depending on what way you approach it. But also fury and rage are such fundamental components, because the vast majority of the individuals that I look after, particularly those with anorexia nervosa, have so much unexpressed rage, and it's so suppressed that they don't even realize that they have it, and it's palpable to the people around them, but they quite often look at me blinking as if to say, I don't know what you're talking about, you know, I'm not angry. And I think, well, why is there so much anger in the room? Because
why is steam coming out of your ears?
Yeah. Whereas, and I find, and again, I'm generalizing, and this is, you know, I shouldn't generalize, but, you know, sometimes individuals who suffer more from bulimia nervosa, it's a bit more sparky and kind of there and right in the moment, you know, there and gone. And it's just different to work with those things. But to think that it can be really hard in a group format, an MBT format, whenever somebody will say, you're angry at me, you're annoyed at me, because I've interpreted that from your face, which has happened to me a few times, because I'm told that I have some kind of resting angry face whenever I'm thinking. And I'm like, genuinely, I'm just thinking. But then whenever it comes to, actually, I am sitting here and I'm really pissed off with what you've just said, that somehow I'm going to have to say that when this person says to me, I think you're angry with me. I'm like, well, actually, I think I am. Yeah. And that's hard to say, you know, but it's so useful. It's so, because then you can hash it out and you can talk about it, and you can give the person the experience of what it's like to be angry with one another and survive. Everything's fine, you know?
Yeah. That speaks volumes to me. One, because I also have apparently a resting angry face, so much so that I had a lecturer at uni that I was super close with, he used to say to me, I hate it when you sit at the front because you frown so hard when I'm teaching you that I think I'm saying everything wrong. And I was like, no, genuinely, it's because I'm so interested and I'm concentrating so hard that I'm like really, like, look really angry at you. And my partner will always say to me, like, please stop frowning, you're making me feel really insecure right now. Yeah. But it's interesting what you say about the anger and maybe not being able to express that anger, because again, I feel like all of this is exactly what I've been doing over the like last month or so in therapy, so I apologize for all the anecdotes, but I have always said I can be happy and I can be sad. I can't feel any emotion in between, and if I'm not in a happy place, I will literally just force myself into that depressed sadness, because I'm like, well, if I'm not happy, then I have to be sad. And we looked at like this wheel of emotions, and there were like five emotions in the middle, two of which being happy and sad, but then there was also like anger and I can't even remember the others. But then each of those emotions then split into like five emotions, and then each of the five then split into like two emotions each. And then we actually looked at anger, and I was like, oh my God, I do feel anger, but I just didn't feel anger in the way that I'd been taught that anger was, that like really expressive, like shouting at somebody. But I felt anger in so many other ways, and that for me was a real penny drop of like, wow, there are so many emotions I can feel, not just this happy or sad. And that for me has been so useful in communicating how I'm feeling with my partner and with my parents, to then, as I was saying before, not having to go into that restrictive state, because I can say, you know, I'm feeling this right now, and be able to explore it with them, rather than, oh, I don't really know how I'm feeling right now, so I'm just going to numb it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Even happy. It's like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Do you know, because I quite often this kind of, the goal is, I just want to be happy. You know, people mm-hmm. will say that, and I'm like, that means absolutely diddly squat to me, because I'm like,
what does that look like?
You know, quite often I hear him happy and I think, what, manic, you know, because it's like, you know, so the word I always use, I'm like, let's aim for contentment seems like a nice state of being. Do you know?
Yes.
But joy or excitement or satisfaction or thrills, or do you know, there's so many little nuances even in that, you know. Or sadness, am I sad because I'm guilty, am I sad because I have experienced loss, am I sad because I looked at the news, or am I sad, who knows, you know. Is it a thought, is it a feeling, is it in my body, is it in my mind, you know. It's so those are the things that MBT hope to be able to open those doors wide, so that people can start to see that their landscape can be a really complicated and colorful picture, and that that's okay, that it doesn't have to be black and white, it doesn't have to be monochromatic, and that you can line 20 people up who say, I have depression, and all 20 of them have a completely different emotion. You know those pictures that they do, the line pictures of cityscapes where it shows all the outlines of the buildings? That it's like, you know, you, everybody has their own, and it's really complicated. But 100 of those people could say depression, but that doesn't mean anything. It literally doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. No, that is such a good point. And I think that depression can like bring it in different emotions. So you can be feeling different things, but also the intensity of things that you could be feeling. And I spoke about this on a podcast that I recorded last week. And I was saying how, like, you know, to somebody, stubbing your toe, that could be the worst pain that they've ever experienced in their life. Whereas to somebody that has maybe been through something that, you know, if we were to kind of put it down on paper, would maybe seem more painful, you know, they would be like, well, the hell, you've just stubbed your toe. Like, I have all this pain. But I guess where, and maybe, I don't know, you can say whether I'm right or wrong here, is where the mentalization comes in is being able to see that, you know, that person is in pain, or that person is happy, or that person is frustrated right now. And irrespective of your personal experience or your personal judgment on the intensity or how that emotion would impact you, it's having compassion for that other person to think, okay, they're feeling that right now. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that I need to accept that and acknowledge that, rather than being like, get over it, or why are you so happy about that, or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, exactly. And the empathy part of it is so important, and being able to both empathize with what it is that they might be going through, but always hold, and they talk about this all the time in MBT, a not knowing stance. I don't know it unless you tell me. And it's kind of, well, actually it's multi-layered. So one, unless you tell me, and two, if I trust that you're telling me the truth. So,
yes.
And that's, I suppose, why we're finding benefits from treating family members and the individual themselves, because what's the point in them opening up their minds to thinking, well, I don't know what my mom or my dad or my brother or sister are feeling, or my partner. So I need to ask them. And then I need to be able to trust that they're going to tell me what it is that they're feeling, so that I can stop second guessing it and torturing myself. But how can you do that if they haven't experienced those skills? And so they continue to say things like the classic, I'm fine, with a really stony face. And so then the patients come back to us and I'm like, I tried what you told me to do. I tried to be open-minded about it, but they said one thing, but I thought another thing. So what am I supposed to do with that? Do you know? Yeah. Instead of just saying, well, no, I'm not fine, but let's think about it together, and let's pick it apart. Or if you want, just say, do you know what, I'm not ready to talk about it at the minute, but it has nothing to do with you. Do you know?
Yeah.
There's so much honesty required. And again, that comes back to the professionals in the room have to be willing to do the same thing, or it doesn't work.
I have a question. So in an ideal world, obviously everyone's going to turn up in the therapy room and be very on board with mentalization and, you know, all great, la-di-da. However, I can categorically confirm that one person I can particularly think of in my family, they have never expressed emotion. And it's that classic, I'm fine, or, you know, not even getting to the point of saying I'm fine, just never talking about it. In that situation, what would you like? How would you guide somebody that, let's say the person in recovery is on board with it, but then, you know, a parent or partner or somebody that, you know, a loved one they don't want to go there? Like, how do you do that? Because at the end of the day, like we were saying before, it kind of needs everybody to go on that journey together for the overall piece to work.
As good question, as always. You really do always go right to the nugget at the, the core of it. Well, I suppose a few things. First, we've usually kind of internally screened before we invite people into the group. We've kind of thought, is this going to work for them or not? And we take chances. So we're fairly broad about that. You know, there's some that I think, oh, I don't know, but we'll try it anyway. There are a few we think, absolutely not. There's no way that this will be too exposing for them. They'll hate it and they won't come, or, you know, they'll sit there with their arms crossed and won't speak. Then it's very difficult because we have to address that their loved one, their patient, might be in the other group and say, this is so frustrating to me because I'm hearing everybody else talk about their mums and dads making great inroads. Mine don't. What am I supposed to do? There's a few different things. So first off, quite often I will see those individuals in clinic if they're willing to come and have a very honest conversation with them. Look, I think you're part of the problem here, and I think if you're really struggling, we need to look at that, but you're getting in the way of recovery. And if it really, really doesn't work, quite often it's a conversation with the loved one to say, look, if you want to keep recovering and this person really will not move despite everything we've thrown at them, then you need to put them in a box somewhere and compartmentalize and get on with your life. Yeah. So, and it's sad because that's last ditch. You know, you don't want to go there. But yeah, there are some people that just are unable, unwilling to shift. They maybe just don't have enough of the skills to even begin the journey, never mind undertake it. And it's sad, but the reality is it can't keep holding you back.
Yeah, I think it is a really interesting thing to think about. And I think from my perspective of my personal kind of way that I've navigated it, is fundamentally, like, in life, you can only control how you respond to things. And you can, I basically had the situation once where I was in a Boots, and me and my mum used to have this thing where on a Friday, like on our lunch break, we'd both go to Boots, we'd get a meal deal, and then we'd go and sit in the park together. And this one particular Friday, we went to get the Boots meal deal, and somebody was kind of scanning the packets and being like, oh, I don't want that one, it's too high in calories, la la la. And I stood there and I thought, oh God, I can't believe that someone's doing this. Like, you know, that whole kind of only focusing on your impact in the world. And I was like, I've got an eating disorder and they're there going on about calories, like, da da da. I didn't even know this person. Of course they weren't going to know that. But I remember getting really frustrated and I walked out of the shop. And actually it was a really good learning experience because it made me realize that I needed to deal with my own stuff and be able to navigate those situations because I couldn't control how other people responded or kind of, you know, their outlooks on life. And I think my thinking about the, you know, if parents or loved ones weren't able to engage in the MBT, it would be that, you know, do your own work and kind of learn how you can respond in those situations. And actually, what's been my experience of doing so much therapy is now people in my family, once they haven't started therapy themselves, they have started to question things a little bit because they can see the hard work I've put in and the benefits that I've gained from that. Because classically their kind of background was, we don't talk about emotions, we crack on with stuff, like, it's too weak to talk about it, there's too much to talk about. But actually seeing me work through it has inspired them, I guess, to start to unpick that quite slowly. So I guess that's another aspect of it, is that people may start to see the progress you make and think, maybe I could consider it, or maybe, you know, gently go about it. I think for some people it does just take more time to get to the point of being able to do that.
Yes, and it's great that somebody like you, I mean, I can see why, even from the few conversations that we've had, how you might inspire somebody else to move on and do things and try to be better. You know, you have that way about you, but it's a big burden to carry, or it's a lot to have to think that am I the one here spearheading this, and and patients will often say, now I have to leave this group and go out into a non-mentalizing world. Mm. And that's really hard, to be this person who's carrying the flag for mentalization, you know. And I mean, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
You know? Shit happens, but yes, some people do take time, and I suppose we have to be appreciative of that. We have to give people that space and that time. And whenever I'm referencing those who you've kind of reached the end of trying everything that you can, I'm thinking about people that literally I've known for the 8 years that I've been in the service, and they're still not moving. And I kind of think, okay, well, do you know, yeah. This is, they haven't been inspired yet, you know, but we keep trying. I'm happy to keep trying. And I think it's just making sure that the patient always knows that the problem isn't located in any one place. I think we're always in trouble when we try to locate the problem in one place. And that's true of everyone and everything. You know, when you see a lot of the public discourse generally, but also discourse with an eating disorder, different people try to locate the problem in, right, so it's the problems in the patient, problems in the family, problems in the system, problems in the clinicians, problems in the, I think it's not in any of those places, it's in all of those places. And that if we can't broaden it out to being located everywhere, and if we're defensive about it being located in any one place, well, we're not going to get anywhere, do you know? So, and if you have the skills, and if you've been taught and you have the insight, well, then you also have the responsibility to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's fundamental with when you're working through eating disorder recovery, is knowing that there's no one thing or one person to blame. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes I can't remember what I was reading, but I was reading something the other day, and it was about trauma in eating disorders. And they were saying, you know, a lot of the time people, when they go through trauma, you know, if we think about sexual trauma, they will want to say it was my fault, you know, maybe I drank too much or I said the wrong thing and therefore it was my fault, because then that gives them back the control of, mm-hmm. I can control when bad things happen to me. And I think it's a similar thing here. It's like, okay, if I blame the reason I've not reached recovery yet on the system, then that takes the onus off me, because I can say, oh, it was the treatment that I received, which is why I haven't got better. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's a really difficult, hard thing to have to admit, okay, maybe it is in part that I haven't been offered the right treatment, but then equally maybe my home lifestyle hasn't been good, maybe I've not been in the right headspace, you know, all of these different contributing mm-hmm. factors. And I think when you can realize that small things in each part need to change to then create that better, bigger overall picture, I think that can be really helpful. And I don't think it feels as overwhelming either, because you're like, oh, I just need to tweak something a little bit there, tweak something a little bit here, and then maybe things can start to move in the right direction, rather than I've got to change the whole NHS system in order to recover from my eating disorder.
Yes, exactly, because good luck. But we, you know, as a clinician in that, there are times that I have maybe made a decision or had a thought or felt a particular way about a case or about an encounter, and I really have to go away and then rejig and be like, wait, hang on a minute, I did that wrong, or I said that wrong, and then I have to go back to the patient and be like, do you know what, hands up, that was wrong, and, you know, let's approach it from a different way, and be willing to say to them, but also you know, you were doing X, Y, Z, and that wasn't helpful, and can we both sit down and now, you know, think, can we do this slightly differently and move in a slightly different direction? And those kind of discussions, it's brilliant. I cannot stress enough that whenever these groups are running, and I have said that the staff kind of, they have a mixture of feeling insulted and also thinking I'm a bit sad, that I say, and I mean it, it's my favorite part of my working week. I mm-hmm. love doing these groups, and I am excited coming in that morning. I'm buzzing. I'm exhausted afterwards, but it is the thing that I most look forward to. And the patients that have been through the group, I have this completely different rapport with. I understand them so much better. They understand me. We, the relationship feels both equitable and yet still I'm the clinician, they're the patient. You know, it hasn't reached that boundary. It's such a useful thing to do. And you have those, then you thrash out those conversations. You know, you said that to me and that made me really annoyed. And well, actually the way you responded made me really annoyed because you were hiding what you felt from me and blah, blah. And you're having that back and forward and it stays in the room and it's confidential and it's safe. And we want to continue developing it. We are gathering up our stats because we want to continue promoting it. We're doing it here in the Belfast and Southeastern Trust, but I've also had people shadow from the other trusts because I'm trying to percolate it out to the other trusts and make sure that everybody in the region has access to it. It's something that I find really, really exciting.
Yeah, and I must say, David, you know, one thing I really admire about you is you can see how much passion and devotion that you have to this. And the fact that you say, you know, it brings you so much excitement and the kind of relationship that you build with your clients and patients, it's really lovely to see. So I did just want to acknowledge that. But I guess my other question on the back of that is, it really, you know, sounds like you're doing a great job in terms of bringing MBT into your service. If there's people that are thinking, oh, do you know what? I think my service could really benefit from this, and clinicians want to bring it into their service, what would your recommendations be for bringing MBT to their patients?
So are you thinking about other national eating disorder services?
Yeah.
Yeah. The short version is just do it.
Find the time.
Well, no, that's interesting actually, because that gets thrown up sometimes as a counter argument, kind of, well, what about the time? You know, this is a lot for a clinic. No, excuse my French, but bullshit. Like, there is, you can make the time if you put the effort in. And also, if we want to be very utilitarian about this and think, okay, you know, I this service is very driven on numbers and how many contacts have you had and how many, well, it's a group, so ching ching, you know, you're getting multiple people in the room for a shorter, you know, and it's done in an hour and a half. I don't buy that. Now, there's a responsibility because you have to do the training, you have to do the supervision, you need space afterwards to reflect on it. It's exhausting, so, you know, I can't jump straight into another appointment usually. I have to have that kind of clear my head. But I'm still seeing anything up to 10 patients in a go for an hour. So I think just go do the training. And if people want to contact me or our service to hear about what we do, I'm here for it. I mention it whenever I'm at the faculty. I harp on about it quite regularly, you know, and it's that kind of different clinicians fall on different camps with regards to therapies. And I'm not strongly in the CBT camp, you know, I respect it. I am glad that there are clinicians in my team who deliver it, and it has really good outcomes for very specific cases. I am much more inclined towards MBT, psychodynamics, psychoanalysis, because I think that people are more complicated than that. And by the time they're coming to us as a tertiary service, the layers of complexity need to be unfolded in a way that's a bit more holistic and a bit more creative.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you've kind of knocked the nail on the head there in that the fact that for some clients, patients, CBT will work perfectly. For other patients, it won't, and you maybe need to explore different alternatives. But I think, you know, a few years ago, maybe because of my own personal experience of CBT being next to just, they did absolutely nothing, I was very much against it. But I've heard people's perspectives that it has helped them. And I think there's a time and a place for everything. And it's about trying, having lots of different therapies that you can pull and you can lean into.
Exactly. You know, at any given time, we might have somebody who's in the group and doing mantra or CBT with their therapist and seeing the occupational therapist for some occupational rehab and seeing the support worker and going out and doing practical experiments in the community. Do you know what I mean? It might be those things are all running simultaneously because that's what they need at that moment. And if we had just gone down that very rigid, this is the criterion and they should be given CBT and that's it, we're going to do that, well, that maybe wouldn't work, you know, so.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's about having that adaptability and being able to kind of recognize when things are working or aren't working and lean into different things. So, David, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat to you again. I feel like even when we're talking about things that aren't maybe the most happy, I still feel very happy chatting to you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I am very sure sometime we will have you back on again when we think of another topic to talk about.
I would be delighted.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much. If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.